are dismissed. They cannot lie. Which begs the question, Count Anvaram, if you dispute the truth from their mouths, would you be willing to step forward and have the same spell cast upon you?
Nay, he said adamantly.
Then kindly keep your peace, and allow these proceedings to proceed, Pentandra insisted. You will be spared such testimony in deference to your rank, but the truth will emerge. And I assure you, she added, no man alive can evade a truth-tell I have cast. Now, Pentandra, let us not be brusque to our guests, I said. Count Anvaram, you deny the veracity of the story? The prince's gift, the six estates, the golden dog?
It sounds like a flight of fancy to me, Count Menelin, he said carefully after a pause.
A golden dog?
It might, I conceded. Thankfully, I had some of my men look into the matter. Would you like to hear what they discovered? Janik, call Planus and Atopal, please. In a few moments, the confused Gilmoran count watched the Remiran adept and the Alshari shadow mage and thief appear, as if summoned. He was speechless as they were admitted to the court and asked for their testimony.
You,
Anvaram said, when he recognized Planus.
You're that merchant.
Ah, yes. You knew me as Antibus of Drenavir, I believe,
Planus acknowledged with a little bow.
Purveyor of coin, victuals, and feed across the Western Kingdom, he said, with a bit of flamboyance thrown in. But in actuality, I am a simple high mage, Planus of Remir, of late in the service of Count Menelin.
Another god's damn wizard,
Anvaram said, shaking his head in disgust.
Two, actually, Atopal revealed, for I was known as Scup in your camp, if you condescend to recall, the dark-haired boy you screamed at about your boots. Alas, I am merely Sir Atopal of Foritus, a shadow mage. I specialize in learning secrets and recovering hard-to-find items, he explained.
In this case, when we learned of the payment the prince made, I had Atopal investigate the reality of the golden dog. What was the conclusion of your investigation, my lord?
Why, under Planner's direction, I had the opportunity to visit the goldsmith in question,
Atopal agreed.
And was there indeed a golden dog?
Pentandra asked, amused.
Judge for yourself, my lady,
Atopal said, drawing a wand and then making appear in front of the court a statue of a dog, nearly 4 feet long, sparkling with gold. From my assays, it is nearly pure, around 5,000 ounces, if you trust my professional opinion.
I can verify the six estates that were likewise given as a gift to my lord count, Planus said, withdrawing those same deeds from a satchel. All very lucrative and proximate to Count Anvaram's holdings, and it appears the bearer of the deed is the owner by these notations, until they are registered with the Castali Ducal Office of Lands, Estates, and Tribute in Wilderhall, which I have been assured they have not been, he commented, as he studied the documents. Pity they are no longer in Count Anvaram's possession.
Anvaram's eyes were uncomfortably wide at that point. Not only had his war been frustrated, and his men hired away from him, but his enemy had captured the funds he had secured to pay his men in the first place, as well as the deeds to the properties the prince had granted him as a bonus for his efforts. His men had been stupidly captured, his camp infiltrated, and his plans upset. More importantly, the entire matter had exposed the patronage and support of Tavard, a sitting duke, for a war against one of his vassals. Too many of his own men had heard the damning evidence, and there was no way to keep them from speaking of it. I'd make certain of that. I had no doubt that Tavard would survive the exposure of the plot. Nor was it that serious in terms of ducal court politics, but it would be highly embarrassing. I also had no doubt that the repercussions would land on Anvaram, first and foremost, damaging the cozy relationship he enjoyed with Tavard and his court. That was apparent from the distraught expression on his face.
But the bride sequestration was real, he insisted. You kidnapped
Lady Matherian, I supplied. One would think that you would know the name of the maiden for whom you went to war, Anvaram. But you do raise an interesting point.
In fact, Baron Astaroth sequestered her over a dowry dispute, as is permitted by Gilmoran custom. You are aware of the custom, are you not?
I am,
he replied, looking a little offended. Yet it is not the custom to whisk a bride away from her own country and deposit her in some rustic prison. A Gilmoran lady is entitled to proper treatment under such circumstances. Then let us call Lady Mytherian and inquire as to her treatment under Count Minolan's care, Pentandra declared. She nodded to Jannik, who made a great show of calling forth the sequestered bride. Of course, we had Mytherian prepared for the spectacle. She was waiting in the Temple of Ishi, still largely under construction, and was brought forth by three priestesses. She looked stunning, having taken considerable effort to prepare herself for her big moment. Her gown was gorgeous, a light blue crushed velvet cut in the traditional Gilmoran style, and she wore a baculus of her own creation. She'd made the most of her time in Vanador, and I'd given her free run of the Bouleutarian. There was an audible gasp from the Gilmorans as the object of their war appeared.
You summoned me, my lord?
She asked when she was brought to the square.
Lady Mytherian, Pentandra began, during your captivity, were you mistreated in any way?
Why, no, Excellency,
she declared, shaking her head.
My accommodations have been every bit as favourable as if I had been in my own home. My escorts and chaperones have demonstrated nothing but the highest respect for me and have sought to ease any difficulties I've had. Indeed, it has been a most pleasant sequestration.
From the lady's own lips, Hanverham, I pointed out. Are you satisfied? Or do you wish to inspect her for rope burns and the scars of beatings? I asked scornfully. That brought a titter from the crowd.
She is still being held in a foreign country, Anverham insisted, crossing his arms defiantly over his chest.
It occurs to me, Count, Pentandra said, addressing me, that the easiest way to conclude this matter is to conclude this matter. Let us settle this dowry dispute here and now, to end the sequestration and remove the offence which these gentlemen have rode so far, fought so hard, and spent so much coin to redress.
That's a fine idea, Baroness, I agreed. Jannik, call Baron Astaroth to the court, please. Jannik announced Astaroth, including all of his many titles, and a few I think he made up just to please the crowd. There was a great deal of applause and cheering as he emerged from the crowd. Astaroth was highly popular in Vanador, as a goodly number of the citizens recalled his wise governance of Tudri, before I burned the town, and many iron banders who'd served in the Penumbra and settled here after their terms had gotten to know him when he was one of the few lords who would offer them aid. Astaroth had been a frequent and flamboyant guest in Vanador for the last year and a half, and had a reputation as an attractive party guest and a heavy tipper. When he appeared, he made as much of a visual stir as his bride. He chose a pure white cloak over his fancy Gilmoran doublet, also of blue velvet, but in a much darker hue than Mytherian's, with a matching mage's cap made of the same fabric. I had no doubt that he coordinated their outfits, because that's the sort of thing Astaroth would insist upon. Instead of carrying a baculus, he wore his mage blade over his shoulder, though he did not wear his combat harness, and instead had it affixed to a rich-looking red leather baldric bearing the arms of Losara. He looked both regal and martial, the very picture of a Gilmoran gentleman.
"You summoned me, sire," he asked, after a stately bow.
"Baron Astaroth, I think it is time that you settle your differences with Mytherian's parents," I instructed him. "If there can be a resolution to the dowry discussions, I think it would be timely."
"I think we can come to some understanding," he said, glancing at his intended bride with undisguised affection. "Don't you, beloved?"
"I am certainly willing to try," she agreed with a smile. "I grow frustrated with these delays to our wedding, for it is my fondest desire to wed you, my lord."
"The dowry discussion cannot be concluded without the girl's parents," Anverham insisted.
"A good point, Count Anverham," Pentandra agreed. "Jannik, please call her parents to the court."
"What?"
Anverham asked, confused.
"They are in Gilmora. I saw them before we departed. It will take weeks to summon them."
"Only if you insist that they travel by land," I chuckled. "We wizards are a bit more efficient.
"Do call the Baron and Baroness, Janik," I commanded. My herald did just that, their names ringing out across the square. In fact, I'd had Astaral cross through the ways and bring them to Vanador the previous evening. They'd enjoyed a small feast with their daughter and caught up on the news. They emerged from the Spell Warden's Hall, Gareth's main office in town, where they had been waiting. Anverham looked confused and outraged over their sudden and unexpected appearance. The Gilmorans in the crowd predictably gasped.
"What is this?"
Anverham insisted as the stately couple passed by him.
"You summoned us, my lord,"
Baron Maynard asked me, after greeting his daughter with an embrace and a kiss on the cheek.
"I wish for you and Baron Astaral to conclude your dispute over the dowry,"
I said. "It is my understanding that the 6 estates you have pledged for the couple are acceptable. Are they not, Astaral?"
"Quite lovely, in fact,"
Astaral agreed. "I took no issue with their generosity, but their stubborn insistence on maintaining hunting and fishing rights to the 2 largest was galling, and their desire to have the ceremony in their homeland was problematic. I prefer to have it in Lasara, as Matherian will become Baroness of that land when we wed. It seems only proper that the Lasarans have that honor." And there were other details of the wedding that we found challenging to come to agreement about.
"Upon reflection, my lord, I would be willing to concede to having the wedding in Lasara if we may throw a reception for our daughter in Benfradine after the honeymoon," her father suggested.
"I would find that acceptable," Astaral said, "and I will concede to allowing hunting and fishing rights as you desired. As I neither hunt nor fish, it is of little consequence," he dismissed.
"Which brings us to the final point of our dispute,"
Matherian's mother said crossly.
"The dress." "Ah, yes,"
Astaral smiled. "The dress. You have not moved on that subject, my lady?"
"The dress?"
Anverham asked, confused.
"What about the dress?"
"I will not wear crinolines," insisted Matherian angrily, "nor will I consent to those silk slippers you proposed. I am not some mere maiden. I am a professional woman. Crinolines expand the skirt and give volume to it," Astaral argued. "It produces a more pleasing silhouette and more graceful lines than a mere petticoat."
"My lines are plenty graceful without that kind of itchy padding,"
Matherian said crossly.
"This is all about a dress,"
Anverham asked, appalled.
"It is my wedding dress,"
Matherian insisted. I was willing to concede to my lord's demands on cut and colour. "But in terms of material, Baron Astaroth's tastes are questionable. Nor will I be wed in slippers, when I already have the perfect pair of shoes for the occasion," she added haughtily. Astaral looked as if he was about to launch into a lengthy and exhaustive defense of taffeta and slippers, but then made a great show of sighing.
"All right, you may wear the silken petticoats," he finally said. "You are so beautiful, and I love you so much that I can deny you nothing." "And the silk slippers?"
she asked sharply.
"Slippers,"
Anverham muttered.
"We went to war over silk slippers."
"And crinolines," Astaral answered. "But the slippers accentuate the delicate nature of my beloved's dainty feet and the shapely nature of her leg. The silk is inherently elegant. She would look stunning in them in temple. But I will concede," he sighed heavily, "for the sake of peace in our lands."
"Are there any additional issues standing on the matter of the dowry?" I inquired.
"No, Count Minolan, we are entirely satisfied," the Baron of Benfradine assured me, after a brief whispered consultation with his wife and daughter. "Wedding in Lasara, reception in Benfradine, hunting and fishing rights, no crinolines and shoes, not slippers. Yes, we are satisfied," he declared.
"As am I," Astaral said, "deeply disappointed but satisfied."
"Slippers," Anverham said angrily. "Crinolines. This was the dispute that led to sequestration?"
"My lady was being quite unreasonable," Astaral explained. "Crinolines are all the rage in Barrowbell right now. I thought it would be stylish."
If my lord would consent to wear crinolines for a few days, he might reconsider his devotion to the style, Mathurian said. If his privates were constantly being assaulted by stiff, itchy fabric all day, I would wager he would reassess the matter entirely. Unstarred silk, on the other hand, while it doesn't produce the billowing effect on my skirts, is entirely comfortable.
One must suffer for one's art, Astaroth said, but I will concede. I release you from your sequestration into the hands of your parents, and I shall see you at the temple.
Have you set a date yet? Pentandra asked, smiling.
Late autumn, Baron Maynard declared. On that we were in accord. It shall take that much time to make the preparations.
If the bride is no longer sequestered, I continued, then there remains no pretext for this war, Count Anvarum. Am I correct?
There is still the matter of your scorn for Gilmoran chivalry, grumbled the Count, defeatedly.
That, alas, will remain, and I will not apologize for it, I declared.
That said, my opinion has risen somewhat, after your men charged at the Battle of the East Bank. While they may be deficient in other areas of warfare, I will concede that the Gilmoran knights charged bravely and effectively into the goblins, and they continued to fight against great odds, obeyed orders from Telamon, and kept peace in their own camp afterwards. Should Gilmora become invaded again, I have higher hopes for their ability to defend it, now that they have tasted real war.
And real war is coming to Gilmora, Pentandra added. The Alshari court was recently informed of a concerted effort by the enemy to establish themselves in the Westlands in order to harass both of our nations. Already plague and undead stalk that poor country, and it sits upon Gilmora's doorstep. No doubt there will be blood spilled there before long. If your men are improved in their response to such attacks, then you should count yourself fortunate for what they have learned in this foray, Count Anvarum, she lectured.
Nor are knights the best or only military response to such things, I added.
For too long, Gilmora has made a mockery of war with tournaments and fighting each other in well-controlled feuds that ignored the realities of real warfare. Why, there has not been a real army in Gilmora since the Alshari dukes brought the fury of the Wilderlords to the Cottonlands before the secession. One might think that the Castali dukes were more interested in keeping your people divided and feuding with each other rather than finding unity and purpose as Gilmorans. It certainly would make Gilmora easier to control that way. But that is just a theory, I smiled.
That ruffled some feathers amongst the Gilmoran knights, who were largely confused by the proceedings. Most were firmly in the political camp that preferred Castali sovereignty over their land, of course. Anvarum's devotion to Tavard and Castal in general had coloured his recruitment for the war. But the pride the Gilmorans held for their country was challenged by the notion of interference in their affairs from either duchy. That wasn't my problem. It was my opportunity. While Anvarum had brought north more than 2,000 belted knights who were loyal to Castal, I'd had planners spread plenty of money around to the Alshari-loving loyalists in Neon. In the absence of opposition, they'd spent the last several weeks pushing the idea that the Cottonlands would prosper much better under the Anchor and Antlers. By the time Anvarum came home, he might well be facing a population hostile to his Castali loyalties, and a Castali court who would see the failure of his war with me and find some way to punish him.
As far as these spies go, I said, gesturing to the three Gilmoran knights who had been patiently waiting to hear their fates, I would hesitate to execute a man who went to war over slippers and crinolines. The fault is not in their loyalty, but in their leadership. Therefore, I sentence them to 3 years' service in the Iron Band, where they may patrol the penumbra and learn real warfare. After that time, they may be discharged back to Gilmora. And these two gentlemen, I said, nodding toward Holcote and Mullinar, will be allowed to accompany Count Anvarum back to Gilmora. At once, I proposed, for he will need all the allies he can get after this adventure.
Do you have anything to say about that, Count?
Pentandra prompted. Anvarum studied us carefully for a few moments. I thought he might stalk away without a word, for he was certainly in a foul mood. But he eventually straightened, bowed to the stage, and managed to speak.
I can see that the wiles of wizards are not merely folk tales, he began. If there is no better lesson to be learned from this incident, it is that our ancestors were correct in how they approached the deceit and treachery of the Magi. Left unchecked, your powers upend the natural order. They sow dissent among the mundane, and your schemes imperil us all.
Then consider yourself instructed,
Pentandra said evenly, her eyes narrowing. I dislike this attitude you have toward mage lords. It seems to have brought you much anguish. Perhaps if you led with your brain and not your lance, you might have seen through some of Count Minolan's strategies. Thank you for your service to the mage law, Count Anvaram. I wish you and your men a safe journey back to Gilmora. And a speedy one, she added. And while you ride, perhaps you will contemplate where you erred during this adventure, and consider the power of silk slippers, crinolines, and a solid gold dog that nearly led you to ruin. As Anvaram bowed and left without another word, I had to question Penny's use of the word nearly. Anvaram would be facing hostilities from all sides when he returned to Neon. If the Castali court was angry enough, then it could even cost him his seat as Count of Neon. Even if he maintained it, his influence would be severely diminished. The price he paid in his little war would haunt him for the rest of his life, I figured. It couldn't have happened to a nicer count. Chapter 37. A Letter to the Prince. Ambition and revenge are wolves who are always hungry. Wilderland's folk saying, from the collections of Janik the Rish. Count Anvaram's party left Vanador before dawn the next morning and rode directly to his encampment on the banks of the Wildwater. Within a day, he began the return journey to Gilmora, earlier than he'd expected. He was defeated, poorer, and humiliated, but perhaps a little wiser. When he left, however, it was only with about a third of his army. Almost 3,000 Gilmorans had volunteered for service in the Wilderlands to fight for the Spellmonger's gold. They rode out of Vanador just after Anvaram departed, escorted by 1,000 Mage Law volunteers and the Verone Free Company. Count Markadine would receive his reinforcements in time. There was plenty of aftermath left for me to clean up when the war was done. While the mundane duties of visiting the sick and wounded, approving spending requests, and making necessary policy decisions was important, having Pentandra and so many other important wizards around was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. After the great oxen roast, I invited select friends and colleagues out to Spellgarden for a few days. We had much catching up to do, and much preparation to conduct.
Things have cooled down in an Ultramar, Pentandra reported, as she relaxed in my workshop at the top of Spellgarden's keep, at least for the time being. The rebellion is all but gone, the rebels are in prison or dead, and the people are beginning to accept the new duchess. There's enough normalcy that Anguin feels comfortable coming to Verone for a few weeks this summer to oversee his affairs there.
Then I will likely miss him, I answered as I poured the wine, as I am planning an expedition this summer. Now that this war is over, I need to execute our plan to investigate Angerspell.
I almost wish I could go with you, she sighed, but it appears a summer in Vanador will be the only holiday I get this year. Duke Anguin wants to spend a few weeks in Verone, too, with the court, and I'll have to attend some of those functions. But it will give the girls some time to experience the Wilderlands, and time for Arborn and me to oversee our respective domains. Perhaps I can finally get my hall built.
That Hedwitch's Croft is still available, I pointed out. Carmella and Gareth won't let anyone near it.
That's where it will be, built over that croft, she agreed fondly. Old Antime, the greatest witch in the Wilderlands. I wonder what she'd say if she saw the place now.
Of course, you and your family are invited to use Spellmonger's Hall in town and Spellgarden while you're here. I'm certain Alia and the children would love the company.
When will you be leaving?
She asked. In a few weeks. Forandas is preparing the expedition. He's been there before, apparently, and knows what to expect, I said, taking a seat across the table from her. It was cluttered with wine goblets, parchments, scrolls, inkpots, and quills.
I hadn't touched much of it in weeks, I realized. I'd been so preoccupied with the war that I'd neglected my scholarship. It will be a small expedition, but important. But I want to meet with the Beryon Council before we set out. I've called a meeting of it in Carnaduin. I've already sent my request to Lady Fallowen. I'd like you and a few others to attend, to represent the human side.
I insist, she agreed. I suppose it would be best to secure the assistance of the Alka Alon, if we're going to chase after an Alka Alon princess? Noblewoman? What would you call her? She asked.
Guardian, I supplied. That's what Aronin means in Alka Alon. Amaras inherited her father's title along with his legacy of guardianship. I'm hoping that the Council can give us some insight on just where to find her, and what we should do if we do find her.
Don't forget, you won't have magic to depend on, she reminded me, although I wonder if the nature of your little toy might have a mitigating effect on the Javelar, she said, pointing to the megalith as it floated around my head. If the snowflake is concentrated snowstone, or whatever, and the megalith's core is a slice of it, then it might permit some flow of arcane power, theoretically.
Yes, I've been speaking with the thaumaturges about that, I agreed. They're very interested in the results. I've considered taking a few with me, and Taran has agreed to go.
He's a good field thaumaturge, which sounds oxymoronic, she conceded, but he's probably better in a fight than most of the other thaumaturges, even without magic.
Didn't you have someone who is supposed to study all of the stuff you're looking for? She asked, her eyes wrinkling. Indeed, I saw wrinkles, something I never thought I'd see on Pentandra's face. Motherhood was hard for her, I knew. Heath the butler, now Heath the arcanist, I nodded. He's preparing a report for us in a couple of days, actually, to review our progress on our various endeavours. He wants to deliver it before I leave.
You should hear it, I added. It will be informative. I look forward to it. Perhaps it will give me some answer for the Faris problem, she complained. The Corsairs are harassing shipping fiercely. The Alshari fleet is scheduled to move out soon, but not to challenge the Corsairs. We're forming convoys for protection, she explained. It's the only way we can manage to get around the peninsula and to Castal and Merwin and Rhaemir, but it will keep us from going after them. As long as they hold Faris, they can close off the bay against us. Anguin wants me to find out if there is anything to be done about it.
Faris is a big job, I pointed out with a sigh, after considering the matter for a moment. I've turned it down 3 times from Rad. I don't think I can take it from Anguin.
I just told you what he wanted me to do, she protested. I didn't ask you to conquer Faris, although from a legal perspective, you could, she added thoughtfully.
She's tits. Why would I want to do that? I exclaimed.
I didn't say you did, she stressed. I said that you could, theoretically, as a Count Palatine, instead of just a regular count. You have the power to conduct your own foreign policy, including what is known as foreign adventures. Wars of conquest designed to increase the count's lands and holdings, she explained. As long as they don't interfere with the rights or sovereignty of your liege, the king, you are free to conduct them. In theory, she reiterated.
So I could declare war on Merwin? I asked.
No, not unless the king allowed it, she admitted. Or maybe, perhaps you could. The Lord Brothers would have to decide.
How about if I entered into a treaty with the Goblin King? I asked, hesitantly. She looked at me sharply, as if I had admitted something, and perhaps I had.
You could indeed do so, since he is on your frontier and his diplomatic disposition is of interest to the security of the kingdom, she reasoned, a faraway look in her eye.
I mean, if you had an opportunity to settle the war with the tribal Gervani in a way that did not harm the integrity of the kingdom, why wouldn't you? It is certainly within your purview as a Palatinate. If it settled some security issues and allowed you to focus your attention on Korbal and his brood, then you certainly would have the justification with doing so.
I'm so glad you said that, I blurted out. I'm considering just that sort of thing.
What? She asked, sitting bolt upright.
You've been in contact with Ashakar?
through the most unlikely of agents. I chuckled. Janik introduced us, or reintroduced us. Sire Kusi is working for King Ashakal now, in exile. He gave us valuable intelligence, which allowed us to prepare for Shakathed. He seems completely free of Sharul's domination now. I suppose that Korbal didn't see much point in it. With free will, he decided to betray the necromancer and ally with the Goblin King. He swore an oath, or something, and he still thinks he's some sort of knight.
That is fascinating, she nodded. Yes, I would say that if you have the opportunity to negotiate a peace, that you should do so. If you think you can trust him, she added.
Pentandra, he's in exile with a remnant of Sharul's forces, with no allies and plenty of enemies. I think I can convince him to free his human slaves. But from what Kusi said, he's got a little statelet up in the northern wilderlands that mimics our Humani forms of government, including a number of human renegades who seem committed to the success of the Goblin King, as well as the support of the majority of the old tribes. So there might be an opportunity. Take it, she commanded. I'll speak to Anguin about it, but it would be welcome news in Phallus if some of our enemies were dealt with, even the little ones. Who knows? Perhaps it will be a step toward a deeper understanding, she said with a shrug. You don't think that the people would consider that a betrayal, after all that has happened? I asked. One less reason to go to war? I think they could stomach that, she chuckled mirthlessly. We've had rebellion in Alshar, war in Faris, invasion in the Wilderlands and Gilmora. Certainly there are those who were hurt who would take issue with any peace. I imagine that's true on both sides. But people are hungry for tales of victory, she decided. A just peace with the tribal Gavani would be just that, and I can get Anguin to support it. Thankfully, there is precedent. The treaty that Prince Tavard signed with Kusi after his defeat in Gilmora. The Crown has already entered into a treaty with the Goblin King. Another with the Mage Law will not be novel. I realized for a moment just how much I had missed Pentandra, her wisdom, her counsel, her cattiness, but mostly her competence. Sure, I could call her up in my head any time to ask her inane questions or whine bitterly about my fate, but she was a busy woman, in charge of many portfolios, and I hesitated to contact her unless the circumstances warranted it. I missed the days when we would banter about the arcane orders, or the future of magic in the kingdom, or the intricacies of power politics at the ducal level, or why a sustained, erotic encounter produced a stronger, vital arcane energy over a quickie in the buttery. But that made me cherish her advice even more, I realized. Thank you, I sighed. I've been concerned about that. But I think it is in our best interest, if we can convince at least some of the goblins to stand down. With Sharul pursuing his long-time goal of being a flashy accessory, most of their desire to kill every human in the world has abated. Don't worry, she sighed. There are plenty of others who want to kill every human in the world. Sharul seems almost cuddly by comparison, she said cryptically. My dearest liege, Prince Tavard of House Bimini, Duke of Castol, Conqueror of Maidenpool, I bring you most heartfelt greetings. My prince, I cannot thank you enough for the assistance you thoughtfully provided this spring when you paid to hire 7,000 Gilmorans to ride to my assistance during my struggles against the Nemavorti. Unasked and unlooked for, Count Anvaram led his host to our aid during a crucial time, and his appearance and intervention spared my realm. I cannot thank you enough for your unyielding support as I established the Mage Law as a strong bulwark against the darkness of the Umbra that threatens us all. I must commend Count Anvaram. He led his men with distinction and committed hundreds of your vassals to a valiant charge against far superior forces. Truly, the valor of the Gilmoran chivalry is worthy of study. Alas, no less than 1,800 valiant Gilmorans perished in the fight. Duin's grace upon them. They died bravely and quickly. I must recommend that the duchy consider some compensation for their families for such noble service.
Likely, this dispatch will reach you before Count Anvaram himself returns victorious to Neon and has time to write a lengthy report to you of his exploits in the Wilderlands. But I feel compelled to give voice to his remarkable performance in the Mage Lore. His keen intellect and strategic prowess know no peer, and he is deserving of every laud you wish to heap upon him. Indeed, so noble was the Count that he insisted upon donating a solid gold statue of a cur that he admitted was a gift of respect and honour to him from your noble self, to the succour of those wounded or injured in the egregious invasions the Mage Lore has had to endure. So moved was he by the plight of his former countrymen who now count themselves subjects of the Mage Lore. Likewise, His Excellency was replete in his praise for his duke. He insisted his adventure was entirely your idea, and admitted that the funds to prosecute such a daring expedition came from your very purse. While I appreciate such largesse, my lord, it comes as an even greater value when I know the duchy is reeling from the expense of the Maidenpool adventure and its attendant consequences. Constructing a fleet is an expensive endeavour, I hear, and your willingness to dedicate valuable ducal resources to the defence of my realm during such a time of thrift and preparation speaks well of your character and your noble bearing. I cannot help but thank the gods for granting me such a benevolent liege. I am asked to pass along the well wishes of your cousin Anguin and dear sister Radine, who are planning to occupy the summer palace at Verone now that the hated rebellion in Alshar has been thoroughly defeated. My lord Anguin thrives in his new marriage, and by all accounts it is a lusty union. No doubt there will be many heirs to issue therefrom in the coming years, you will be gratified to know. Your darling daughter should have many, many cousins with whom to play in the coming years. As my enemies are defeated, like so many bandits, and my realm settles into a blissful prosperity, I must credit the wise leadership of my liege, Prince Tavard, for inspiration during these dark times. Your determination to reconquer Faerys at your own expense gives me encouragement to pursue policies I once feared were too bold. I will, therefore, take guidance from my prince's illustrious career and consider some sort of concord with Ashakal, the self-styled Goblin King with whom your Highness once entered into a treaty of peace. Should I prove successful, perhaps some part of the animus our foes feel for us will abate. I cannot thank you enough, Your Highness, for the opportunity to develop my realm here in the Mage Lore. Had you not given me the justification for spending 3 years apart from my beloved Sevendor, I never would have built this rugged land and its likewise rugged people into the finely honed nation it is becoming. It is a small land in population, and perhaps the manners of the Wilderfolk are crude by some standards. But the local iron has provided some small opportunity for them to thrive in their defence of their lands. I have high hopes for their industry. Perhaps someday their craft at metallurgy will add to the glory of the kingdom of Castalshar as much as it has inflamed the glory of Alshar. In closing, my prince, I urge you to be cautious of those within your inner circle in these troubled times. I have received intelligence of infiltrators from the court of Korbal, the necromancer, and I fear his designs. The schemes of the enemy are manifold, and their enmity is manifest. Beware those who seem most loyal to your commands, the most eager to see them executed, and realize that the secrets you entrust to them may not be secure. The deceits of the enemy are many and obscure. Fall not prey to them, as they are designed to doom us all. I have no doubt that you will be able to readily discern their intent, however, as no more insightful duke has ever sat on the throne of roses and swords. I bid you and your lady wife, for whom the entire Mage Lore prays, the sacred grace of Trigg and the beneficence of Luin during these dark times. And to your daughter, I wish nothing but the utmost happiness and health. Please extend my greetings and respects to your revered parents, his and her royal majesties. But to your mother, I humbly beg you pass along my especial greetings. I am always thoughtful of her concerns over me and my family, and wish to assure her that I am just as attentive to hers. Minelin, called the Spellmonger, Count Palatine of the Mage Lore, Baron of Sevendor, Chief of the Arcane Orders, and Marshal of Alshar and Castal.
Your Excellency, Lord Brother Bright said, after he read the letter aloud to me in its final form. May I assure you, with all due respect and honour, that in my career I've never met someone so adept at being a sarcastic asshole as your noble and arcane self? The monk asked. Oh, come now, I objected. That letter was dripping with respect, in big steaming piles. Far more than is due for any person you are not actively having a baby with, the Lord Brother agreed. Indeed, the insults pop from the parchment like daisies in the spring. You all but insult his wife and call his child a bastard, he observed. If you can think of a good insult for his wife, let me know, I nodded sagely. She's as ignorant as a vapid village maiden, but I can't tell her that because she wouldn't understand it. I tried to prepare her for her role as Tavarn's bride and a future queen once. It didn't go well.
Remirans,
snorted my chancellor. Still, my lord, I have a duty to point out that sending such an inciting letter may not be in the best interests of you or your realm. Sovereign nobles have a history of taking such correspondence amiss, he said airily. He should have thought about that before he used my tribute money to fund such a foolish expedition, I growled. Really? You'd have to be an idiot not to think of 1,000 better uses for that gold. But a good wizard makes a habit of turning fools' blunders into wise policy. If Tavard has that kind of coin to throw around, the least I can do is make certain that it is thrown in a productive direction, I argued. I'm certain that will completely mollify His Highness, Bright snickered. You seem determined to make him your enemy. More that I'm determined to convince him that I am his enemy, I corrected. But you are not wrong. Rad has noble intentions. Grandine has dark intentions, but is willing to put them into the service of the kingdom and her royal husband. Radine has wit, cleverness, and bile, I observed, coupled with a predator's instinct for violence. But Tavard, I proposed. He has enjoyed a lifetime of expert tutors in every subject, and taught the lessons of leadership by example as well as by rote. Yet he's a half-ignorant, incompetent boob, and everyone knows it, including him. Maiden Paul cinched that, I insisted. He's ignorant. Okay, perhaps only half-ignorant, Brother Bright agreed, but that does not diminish his power. One might ask if it is wise to poke a wounded bear in his uninjured eye, he said philosophically. By sending this letter, you are challenging him in a way he cannot ignore. My very existence challenges Tavard in ways he cannot ignore. Still, I continued, I cannot allow him to believe that his venture was even remotely successful. Else he might consider coming against me with even more force, when I don't happen to need an army of fops around to soak up damage from the forces of darkness. It is not his armies, I fear, Bright considered. There are many ways for nobles to make war, and the battlefield is just one of them. The courts, he listed off, public opinion, the clergy, trade, taxation, politics, regulation. Tavard may be half ignorant and not terribly bright, but he is surrounded by loyalists who are. Count Anverham, notwithstanding, he admitted. I'm aware, I sighed, but I am hoping that if I humiliate him just enough, he'll back down and leave me alone, and that, perhaps, in time, he might become more than half ignorant. I have far more important things to deal with than a vengeful princeling. So, let me add my seal, I said, and I cast a spell that imprinted my seal across the bottom of the page. Now, send it to Wilderhall, if you would. By the ways, not by mirror array. I want this brought to his attention immediately. Well, if you are going to poke a bear in his eye, best to do it swiftly, I suppose, mused the monk, as he sanded the parchment out of habit, and then rolled it and sealed it with wax before he left.
For once, I agree with a monk, came a voice from behind me after a brief flash of light.
I turned to see Brigga, goddess of fire, emerging from her divine flame.
It isn't wise to agitate your current liege lord and future monarch. Of course it isn't, I grumbled. At least not on the surface. But I need to contend with this relationship before it gets out of hand. He waged war on me. I don't respond to that lightly.
You all but goaded him into it, Brigga said, tossing her dark red curls over her shoulder.
But he was planning on doing it anyway. You should expect him to make a move on Sevendor next, after this.
I do,
I agreed. I've asked Sire Kay to come here for a quick meeting before I leave. I'll prepare him for that. But I think the Tavard's attention will soon be drawn elsewhere, like toward Faris. As he is responsible for losing it, his nobles think it's his responsibility to recapture it, before the Al-Shari do. So, to what do I owe this divine visitation? I asked politely.
Checking in, mostly,
she admitted. Then she paused.
I hear you're seeing another goddess.
A couple, actually, I chuckled. Falassa and Bova. Bova actually proved useful, I added.
I saw, she said a little guiltily. She's adopted your wife for some reason. She's an unusual divinity,
Brigger said. I got the feeling that she wasn't sure if she liked the other Bova, or if she was unsure if she did or not.
I think she appreciated the great oxen roast, and I guess we'll be working together as patron divinities of the Mage Law.
That might be the only beef we get for a while. All those cows disappeared.
They aren't gone, merely congregating in a secret place,
Brigger confided.
One vast herd, like a forest fire of cattle,
she decided.
But she did end the war rather decisively and unexpectedly.
There's still plenty of evil out there, I chuckled. Korbal awaits.
Among other dangers,
she nodded, studying me.
But that was most of his reserves who got trampled. There won't be any large goblin armies invading the kingdom for years yet. The army and city you have built will keep them at bay, and finally allow the people of this tortured land to restore it to prosperity. You have managed to purchase some time, if not some peace. You will need every moment of it,
she said cryptically. The third Nemofort. Karakush, I answered.
He is the smart one, Minilin,
she warned, smart enough to undermine his competitor by leaking information to his foe. But do not trust him to be anything other than determined to slay you. He just wants to be the one to do it. And there is more. While his comrades were learning how to fight against you, Karakush has been studying you. Human culture and civilization, commerce, government, literature, history, magic, that sort of thing. Perhaps he'll become an admirer of humanity and quit the field out of his great respect for us, I proposed.
Minilin, he's studying you to understand how better to destroy you, she countered, pouting a little. He's been watching how your people react to various situations. It's clear that the old Alka-Alon way to make war doesn't work as well against you, so he's adapting. He might be the most dangerous Nemovort you've faced yet. He may even have designs on Korbal's position at the head of the Enshadowed.
I think the Enshadowed need a little civil war in their ranks, I considered. Indeed, I would count it a boon. She shook her fiery head.
Korbal's control over his subordinates is absolute. None of them would try to unseat him directly. But his decaying state could tempt them. He has used powerful spells to extend his life in that horrible body, but they have side effects too. He has to go into a kind of torpor periodically to allow some of the decaying flesh to regenerate, especially if he strains himself to use the Malapar as he has. It might have bought him time, but it also shows weakness to the ruthless thugs he's gathered around him. One day, someone will think they can get away with it and take a shot at him. Karakush may well be that Nemovort.
So how do we defend against him? I asked. How do we attack him?
It won't be easy to do either, she admitted. When you see an army, you build a castle. When you see an assassin, it's usually too late. He's already sent spies here. He will send more. As long as you and the Megareth are here, he will come after you.
Well, thankfully, I plan to be on holiday this summer, the expedition to the north. But I'm leaving behind Janik the Rish. He's my new head of counterintelligence, as well as being my court bard.
Ah, the Rish, she said fondly, one of my beloved. His poetry is magnificent. Not the doggerel he performs for you lot, but the epics and ballads he's composed over the years for his own entertainment. Those are works of art. He has a quick wit and clever mind. You will be well served by him. His family was ever a favourite of mine.
She paused and looked at me carefully.
and I endorse that plan you have to reward him.
I haven't really spoken about that to anyone, I said, taken aback.
I'm a really good guesser, she snorted sarcastically. But you should do it, before you go north. It will be good for the Mage Law, and for Janik.
All right, I conceded. I want to keep the man loyal to me, and he more than deserves it.
If you do, he will become your steadfast man, she nodded. And your arcanist, Heath? He's been performing brilliantly, as you shall see. He's discovered more about our history than you expect. He will be key to unlocking the secrets of the ancients, perhaps even rescuing the Forsaken.
I hope so, because I've done bugger all to solve that one, I admitted. I don't have enough information yet.
And when you do, Heath will assist you in putting it together. He has a gift for that sort of thing, as well as putting the right people together, she continued, pacing a little. That may be more important than anything. You have built a lodestone out of Vanador. It will attract the greatest creative minds to it. Heath will arrange them to serve you best.
Nice to know he's worth his wages, I grunted as I watched her pace. She was preoccupied by something which is not something you expect in a goddess.
The machine will be helpful too, she continued, now that it is mobile. But be cautious of it, Minilin. Your ancestors built them, and they were instrumental in settling here, but they were also dangerous. Controlling. At some point, your ancestors did away with them for the most part, she explained, even though they made their society work. Think about that, Minilin. There had to be a good reason to get rid of something that useful.
They did away with them, I asked, surprised.
Somehow, yes, she agreed. That was before my time, of course, but I've heard rumors. That's one of those things Heath should look into. Why did the colony disconnect their thinking engines? This machine of yours may be harmless and will decidedly be useful, but it isn't to be trusted, she warned.
I sighed and took a few moments to think. Forseti had been increasingly useful since he was able to escape his cave and had spent countless hours discussing and lecturing me and my staff on all manner of subjects, from metallurgy to music. There was a thick volume of notes concerning our conversations now in the hands of Ruderal, Gareth, the Lastian, Heath, and myself, as well as the few other guests I'd permitted to interrogate the ancient machine. Our vision of what our ancestors had created was far more complete now. But this was the first I'd heard about them getting rid of their thinking machines. I had always assumed that they had fallen into disrepair after the sinking of Perwin, but Brigga hinted at a more purposeful removal from human society. Why, indeed, would they do that to their greatest achievement? I'll keep that in mind, I said, nodding. I'll be taking Forseti with me to Angerspell. I'd say to watch my back, but he doesn't quite come up to my knee. He says that there's an ancient installation there that may answer some of our questions, I informed her. That raised some bright red eyebrows.
Really?
She asked, surprised.
He believes it is intact.
The cave we found his little chariot in was more or less intact, I argued. He says this installation was well fortified, and he believes it might have survived. It's worth investigating while we're there.
Agreed,
she sighed, producing little wisps of white smoke out of her nostrils when she did so.
As much as I mistrust such things, it appears as if we have no choice, if we are to learn the truth.
Or what is left of it. I wonder if our ancestors discovered that the world was going to end in 3,000 years. I can't imagine them wanting to stay here, if that was the case.
They probably thought they could fix it, Brigga said, shaking her head. That has ever been your race's flaw, the hubris to think that you can challenge the gods and the nature of the universe.
We're here, aren't we? We managed to get ourselves from our home world, the Kalador. Without magic, I added. That has to be worth something.
I don't think the universe really cares, Brigga said with a shrug. At most, it cares just the tiniest bit enough to send us gods to watch over you since you destroyed your civilization. Maybe.
Well, that's not theologically reassuring at all, I scowled.
For me, either, she admitted. Your folk have ascribed great and complex relationships among the gods, as though we were organized and institutionalized. The truth is far scarier, that we barely know what we're doing and barely know each other. We are all just expressions of the divine energy, made manifest through the collective will and outspoken needs of the human subconscious. Our power might be great individually, but it does not grant knowledge beyond our ken, nor understanding. I'm hoping that our newfound persistence will allow us to fix some of that. Anything that promotes the stability of the divine I can support, I chuckled. But it is disappointing that you don't know all the answers to life's largest questions. In truth, we don't even know all the questions, she agreed. We can still be surprised. Like Bova's response to your enemies. I had no idea that she could do that. I don't think she did either, to be honest. Or perhaps she did. But she promised that she could help. She fulfilled that promise. I can respect that. As did you and the other persistent gods, each in their way. I'll take that help regardless of whether or not you know all the answers. And if I find a little psychological comfort in that during these stressful times, all the better.
I'm glad you think so, Minilin,
Brigger agreed, as she disappeared into a cloud of smoke that suddenly appeared around her feet and then rose to over her head. You're going to need it sooner than you think.
Chapter 38. The Arcanist Speaks. When wise men speak, open your ears. Wilderland's Folk Saying, from the collections of Janik the Riche. The Thaumaturgic College was still so new that the faint musk of wattle and daub and whitewash had not yet left the structure when you entered the hall, nor had the clay tiles on the floor yet become worn or scuffed with use. Though the remainder of the building had yet to be constructed, the main hall and a few bays were complete enough for some basic workshops and an archive to be of use. The largest chamber in the building was not for books and scrolls, but for people. The lecture hall, a broad, largely empty room filled only with chairs, all facing forward, like a theatre. At the head of the hall stood one fairly imposing wooden lectern, behind which Heath the Arcanist stood, telling us how doomed we all were. He did so in cheerful tones and with a certain glee I felt he enjoyed just for knowing something that few others did, even if it was the end of the world. Indeed, he appeared a bit giddy as he carefully told us just how screwed we were, due to the tangled skein of troubles we'd inherited from our ancestors. I had invited a small but select group to attend the event. Most were magi, of course, men and women who had worked for me and whom I trusted to keep this lecture to themselves. Others I included, despite their lack of regira, because I felt their input would be helpful, or I thought they should be informed of the wider situation beyond feudal politics and genocidal goblins. Those included Janik the Riche, certain political figures, and select members of the clergy, who might add something beneficial to the discussion. I considered all of them trustworthy, and none of them were Alka Alon or Terra Alon. This was a discussion of humanity's future, and I could not really trust even my closest friends among the Alon about this. Along the back wall stood more than a dozen of attendants who were considered important enough or sufficiently well-connected to merit attendance. That included several apprentices, including Ruderal and Allura, Pentandra's blind apprentice, as well as the two human sky captains. Heath delivered the address with flair and style, despite the hopeless nature of the situation. His red hair was freshly barbered, and his beard was cut close. He frequently paced and threw his arms around for emphasis. For a few hours during his presentation, I felt like I was back at Inarian Academy, learning about imperial history, or thaumaturgy, or the like. But what Heath the Arcanist had to say was troubling. We have here, my friends and colleagues, a tangled nest of competing matters, all of which are related to the other, and all of which must be solved, he insisted, as he gripped the podium possessively. There are dangers and doom in each of them if we are not careful. In fact, even if we are careful, we will skirt the frontiers of destruction again and again if we pursue our salvation. I hesitate to bring order to this tangle, in that speaking to any of these matters first might convince you that they are the most important. In truth,
All are important to us, else we would not be concerned. Therefore, take my listing as a point of discussion, not a schedule of priorities." He began pacing slowly across the small dais as he recounted each factor and summarized it for those who were perhaps uninformed. "I bring to you first the matter of Castelshar," he said, as he cast a large mage map above his head, displaying the entire kingdom. "Our kingdom has managed stability in its short life, which is nothing short of miraculous. Yet, though the challenges of political consolidation and rebellion have largely been met, there are dangers lurking on the horizon that will continue to threaten the state. Namely, the poor performance of Prince Tavard, the defection of Princess Ra'din to Alshar, the muddy succession in Rhaemir, the continued skirmishing with Merwin over Wenshar, the loss of the Frisian Peninsula to a pirate regime, and most importantly to us, the continued incursions by the forces of darkness that want to kill us all and eat us," he concluded. "Each of these factors may weaken the institutions and economy of the kingdom as a whole," he continued. "The recent restructuring of tribute payments through the counts instead of the duchies has helped, in my opinion," he said thoughtfully. "But that is but one step towards salvation. Thankfully, the one portion that is most dangerous to the mage law, the aforesaid forces of darkness, are currently under control. That will, hopefully, give us time to contend with these other factors. I hesitate to use the word inevitable," he continued, briefly consulting his notes, "but we are going to end up at war with Merwin. The Duke of Merwin sees Ra'd's establishment of Castelshar as a direct threat to his regime and a challenge to Merwini sea power. The skirmishing over Wenshar recently indicates that he is already probing us. The institutionalization of the Knights of Nablus out of the corpse of the Royal Censorate demonstrates that he understands the nature of Castelshar's military advantages. But his lack of magical resources, namely Irionite, keep his magi controllable in a way that we, alas, are not," he said, to a chorus of snickers. "The matter of Castelshar will involve resolving the Wenshari and Merwini situations somehow. It will also require that Faris be dealt with and brought under the crown," he proposed, "but it will also have to address the unfortunate succession possibilities. While I feel that the mage lands of the Mage Law, Sevendor, Robinwing, Moros, Greenflower and others are largely secure for the moment, the possibility of challenge from a future regime is strong. Encouraging greater ties amongst the Magi will therefore remain important. Thankfully, we have enjoyed strong and wise leadership," he said, glancing up at me and Pentandra, who were sitting in the first row. "We come now to the matter of the Enshadowed, which is inclusive of the Umbra, Olam Seheri, Korbal the Necromancer, Sherul the Scepter, and Ashakal, the Goblin King," he continued. "And while this matter seems dire, recent events have given us hope in our struggle against it. Korbal sits in anticipation of his own doom, thanks to the megalith," he continued, like a monk delivering a sermon. "Sherul has been neutralized, thanks to Korbal's betrayal. The Nemavorti compete for their master's favour, and while their resources and magic are strong, they suffer from some debilitating penalties that may prove decisive. Ashakal's regime in the northwest, while robust, is not strong enough to provide a challenge to the Mage Law. Indeed, it is a reaction to the triumph of the Magi in this struggle. The evolution of a second pole of power amongst our enemies cannot be underestimated," he emphasised. "Division between the Goblin Kingdom and the Umbra may also prove decisive. The tribal Gavani tire of war, and seeing their children transformed into Maragorku. Despite their historical hatreds, they chafe at being the instruments of oppression over humanity. There are rumours of native prophecies that threaten the rule of the Nemavorti, for instance, and there is a vein of defiant resistance to the rulership of any Alka-Alon that fuels the tribal Gavani willingness to rebel against Korbal's regime. Korbal's reserves are spent," he insisted. "His ability to project force is now limited to magic, deception and treachery. Without the power of the megalith, he is condemned to a hellish existence in a rotting body.
Minelan reports that he must now languish in a state of torpor to extend his life, and that the use of the Malapar has weakened his constitution. The great power of Sherul and the Malapar cannot sustain him. Until he can raise another generation of Gavani, even Maragorku, he will not have sufficient soldiery to contest our rule here in the Wilderlaw. Heath paused just long enough to sip some water from a goblet on the lectern before he continued. Next is the matter of the Alka Alon, he said, as the mage map above him changed. The land forms were the same, but the designations and legend had changed. That is, the proper Alka Alon authorities, who have ultimate rulership over lands we think are our own. No, he insisted, as a chorus of murmurs erupted from the crowd, the Alka Alon Council has oversight of what they call the Humani Colony, in terms of the world of politics. We are their pets, their livestock, their hobby. Humanity was forced upon the locals, and they must contend with us. Indeed, they are held responsible for our behaviour. He grinned. Some may see the Alka Alon as saviours, he said, as he glanced up at the mage map. In truth, they are caretakers, if not wardens. Their job in regard to our people is to ensure that we don't do anything that would embarrass the Alka Alon Council, and to use us to counter the Enshadowed. We are therefore useful to them, particularly with the establishment of the Berian Council. We do their dirty work, he said with a sneer, while they sing songs and harvest magical nuts. We buy time while they build their means of escape from this world. For, he continued, as the assembled muttered about the revelation, as we struggle for simple survival, the Alka Alon play a deep game. Their devotion to this world, despite their protests, is limited, he said, enunciating the word. Even amongst our closest allies, the Terra Alon faction, their support for us is woefully pragmatic. We are the sword they use to parry Korbal's blows, while they prepare to abandon Kalador to its unseemly fate. There was a lot more murmuring now. Few had understood the nature of the Alka Alon Alliance, perhaps me, Pentandra, and a few others. But as Heath continued to inform them, a growing unease spread throughout the crowd. After all, the Alka Alon were supposed to be mystical giants in the realm of magic, not hucksters trying to convince a bunch of ignorant rubes to die in battle on their behalf while they prepared to abandon the world. The Alka Alon, he continued, knew that the world was doomed before they came here. The sagas confirm it. Under casual questioning from myself and others, we've been able to establish a pattern of deception and manipulation by our erstwhile allies that goes back centuries, likely to the original colonization. Yet they were willing to accept our help and establish our colony, despite knowing that it would ultimately be futile. The proof of this is subtle, but undeniable, he said, consulting his notes. In no less than 7 of the 19 Alka Alon epics translated in the early years of the colony, references made to the departure indicate that the Alka Alon were well aware of the finite nature of Kalador. While their affection for the world is evident, so is their intent to flee before the coming doom. After intense consultation with some of our own resources, it becomes clear that we were a useful and novel foil for our allies. They do not expect us to be able to solve the problem of our doom, and they are perfectly content to use us to purchase time and resources to ready their own escape. Nor did they readily share with us the nature of the doom. Indeed, every discussion of that sort of thing is cloaked in layer after annoying layer of obfuscation and deception. They depend upon our ephemeral lifespans to reduce our race to willing, if ignorant, servants, not partners. The vaunted emissaries they authorized are designed to placate us, to mollify our questions and give us the illusion of assistance, even as the Alka Alon conspire to abandon our world in its time of greatest need. Even the assistance of the Terra Alon, as dedicated as they are to supporting humanity, is fraught with deception, if you are subtle enough to see it.
While this might be insulting, Heath continued, pursing his lips, it also provides us opportunities for answers. For the Alka Alon are not ready to depart. They are just beginning their preparations. And I believe, based on some quiet investigation and some shrewd guesswork, that they are troubled that one of their planned means of escaping Kalidor, the Malapar of Beauval Castle, is currently controlled by one of their most violent and psychopathic dissidents. That produced a gasp in the hall, as we realized some of the motivations behind the Alliance were self-serving. What if the reason that the Terra Alon were helping us was to liberate their escape route from Korbal? It also explained why Korbal was so anxious to secure the Malapar, through his Gavani surrogates. By controlling it, he was forcing the Alka Alon to contend with his brutal ideology. It was leverage, we all realized, against the greater Alka Alon society. Which meant that defeating Korbal, for all the good it did for us, would also allow the Alka Alon to leave, and leave humanity behind to endure the horrors of a dying world. Conversely, if they ended up negotiating with Korbal and the Enshadowed for access to the Malapar, they could flee and leave him in charge for a few millennia. That, too, was a horrific thought. Heath waited for the murmuring to die down, and then he continued. There is some indication that the Alka Alon have misplaced some of their means to escape this world, he said diplomatically. We know that the greater part of their ancient mastery of magic was put away after they abused it in their wars against each other. We also know that there is a growing sense of alarm over them recovering it. I would propose that if they do recover it, that their use for humanity will decline, as will their commitment to this alliance. We turn now to the matter of the Forsaken, he said, his tone brightening as he produced another leaf of notes. Many of you are not aware, but there has long been lore that has referred to an ancient force called the Forsaken that has haunted our culture since before the Narassi invasion. These shadowy figures were cloaked in mystery until recently. Ancient orders dedicated to their attention survive unto this day. But it took a revelation to Count Minilan at council with the Alka Alon to explain this mysterious and dangerous myth. As many of you have also learned, the origins of humanity on Kalidor are not divine. We came here in a great skyship, so vast as to be unimaginable. That ship was known as the New Horizon, and it founded the human colony on Perwin, among other places. For more than a century, the New Horizon slowly delivered human colonists onto this world. But then, some crisis forced or persuaded our ancestors, soon after the first Archmage rose to power, to abandon the last tithe of colonists and the entire ship itself. Its location is unknown, perhaps unknowable. But the records and the lore suggest that there are things of great power on that ship, and perhaps as many as 25,000 of our ancestors frozen in time. Did our ancestors know about the coming doom? He asked rhetorically. Perhaps. We know that the Alka Alon know no way to prevent it. We assume the Vundle, commonly known as the Sea Folk, cannot prevent it. But both races were impressed and intrigued by our ancestors' non-magical expertise. They reclaimed these lands from wasteland, after all, when the Alka Alon could not. They crossed the void without magic. They constructed great skyships and sea ships, and had resources we can scarcely imagine. While we trip over the remnants of their great civilization, we can assume that much of it is preserved aboard the New Horizon, as well as the people who understand it. If they have some means, or at least some understanding about the eventual death of Kalidor, then perhaps they also have a way to stop it. But we don't know, he said, his voice growing dark. We don't know, because we were stripped of that resource and that knowledge when the Forsaken were abandoned. Thankfully, among the records that were preserved was the assurance that there was, indeed, a means of recalling the New Horizon at some future point. I would say the time to do so is approaching. Lastly, we have the matter of the Vundle, he said, flipping over his notes. The Sea Folk, the true masters of Kalidor.
While the Drylands are merely an afterthought in their minds, from what we understand, and all of these other matters are trivial to them, there is no doubt that they understand the approaching doom better than any, and find themselves, despite their great power, unable to prevent it. But they also know that a similar catastrophe was prevented in the past by their own ancestors, uncounted years ago. Therefore, the key to the salvation of our descendants is likely bound up with the Vundle, he explained. Understanding their strange race and establishing meaningful communication with them would certainly facilitate any attempt to rescue our world. But, until recently, we had little to offer them, save perhaps amusement. Now we have Snowstone, he continued, and I winced. I had taken great pains to keep the Vundle's hunger for Snowstone a secret, but now was the time for sharing that secret, if we were to hope to prevail. Heath sought out my eye in the crowd, and I nodded in permission. The Vundle have a great desire for the stuff, more than we do, and count it unique in their experience. We aren't terribly certain what they do with it, but they love it, and they want more. And we have a finite supply. It is theorized that if we can repeat the magical event that created the stone in the first place, we will have a bargaining chip with which to catch the attention of the Seafolk and perhaps enlist their aid in challenging the inevitable doom. For, unlike the Alka'alon, the Vundle have no place they can go, no means of escape. They will die here with their world and with us. Therefore, they have an interest in working with us. If we can prevent the doom, and we have something that they desire, Snowstone. If we can somehow use these two facts to persuade them to take us seriously, then perhaps we have a chance to stop this catastrophe. Those are the five matters of Kalidor, as I have seen them, he concluded. There might be more, but these are the five most pressing problems we face. In preparation for the upcoming Beryon Council with the Alka'alon, Count Minolan wished all of his most trusted people to be properly informed on the scope and scale of these problems. Would you like to explain why, Your Excellency? He asked, and gestured to the podium. Yes, I agreed, pulling myself to my feet, and I will entertain questions. But first, I'd like to thank Heath for his intensive explorations and organization of these matters. I assure you, I said with a chuckle as I got behind the podium, that this was but the briefest of briefings on each of those subjects. Our arcanist has assembled a small library on each and is continuing to gather information to better our understanding. The reason I wished for him to address you is that while I and a few others have discovered much of this over the last few years, it occurs to me that if I break my neck in a riding accident or blow myself up with a magical experiment, none of this would be acted upon. Therefore, I wish to inform as many intelligent, creative, and trustworthy magi, I said, emphasizing the word, to help me carry the terrible burden of this knowledge. As closely as we work with the Alka'alon, we must be aware of the limitations of that alliance and the motivations of our allies, as well as our enemies. Only by being fully informed, as we begin our councils, can we assure that humanity's best interests are spoken for. I gazed out over the audience and saw expressions ranging from the thoughtful to the angry. Are there any questions? I asked, knowing that there would be an avalanche of them, or I didn't select the right people to attend. I picked Astaral first. Could you explain all of this doom language? He asked. It's a little confusing to some. From what we can determine, Heath said, with consideration, due to naturally occurring circumstances that we do not currently understand, magic will slowly cease to exist in about 3,000 years. That's not just a threat to our profession, but a threat of extinction of all life on Kalidor. I took up the explanation from there. A goodly portion of the plants and animals in our world use some variation of magic in their biology, I said. Losing magic would make them extinct, it is theorized. The cascade of crisis that would occur by eliminating even a tithe of them would soon affect everything else. That would eventually lead to wide-scale famine, starvation, and extinction. But that is not the immediate danger of losing magic, I continued, for the Seafolk long ago imprisoned a race of invaders known as the Formless,
within the darkest depths of the oceans, and they use a strong magical barrier to contain them, from what we've learned from the Alka Alon. When magic fails, so will those barriers. And once the formless are loosed, they will ravage what remains of the sea folk, then all life on land. That is the immediate danger.
3,000 years doesn't sound particularly immediate to me, Thinradl said dryly. I'm thinking I'll have another engagement that day.
I waited for the giggling to stop before I answered him. I do understand that such a great age from now seems like a small concern for us. How many human generations would have to live and die before that came to pass? But that doom affects our lives even now, and will continue to for centuries to come. Being unaware of it would be unwise. Being dismissive of it would be a betrayal to our descendants.
It may be 100 human generations away, Heath said, but that's just a generation and a half for the Alka Alon, and a few months, relatively speaking, for the Vundle. With the former fleeing and the latter all but giving up in despair, if we want to solve this problem, then we have to take the steps necessary to take an institutional approach to the matter.
What about the other race, the Met-Sakinsa? Pentandra asked, her brow furrowed. Do the Moonriders have any wisdom in this?
Have you met one to ask, my lady? Heath answered gently.
I haven't. Nor, to my knowledge, have many human beings. While they are known to the Alka Alon, they are more of a mystery than the Vundle, though the Alka Alon texts demonstrate a deep affection for the race. All we really know is that they are a plant-based species. They came here somehow in a moon, and legend says that somewhere far across the sea there is an entire island of theirs that is covered with them. But I wouldn't know one of the Met-Sakinsa from an apple tree, he admitted.